You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. Now, this episode is about the most vital and urgent issue facing us and the future of the planet we live on. Sustainability. This is the second in our sustainable diet series and we'll focus on the consumer. We'll be looking to debunk the myths and explore the facts behind sustainable diets, but we're not going to be talking in a fluffy, faddy, conceptual way. Oh no! We want to link it directly to the consumer and work out how we change people's behaviour to bring sustainability into the mainstream, and how to make that sustainability sustainable. You'll see what I mean when we carry on. Now, what are the complexities of this issue and how does it relate to the food industry's core aim of, let's be frank here, making money? Because if the food companies can't make money, then they're not going to support change. Now, we've assembled a panel of fantastic experts and they're going to start off by introducing themselves and telling us their favourite sustainable food or sustainable food fact, starting with Ursula.
My name's Ursula Ahrens and I'm a member of the British Dietetic Association, and more specifically I'm a member of the expert group looking at environmentally sustainable diets. So I've got a great interest in the subject. Favourite food, I think, is anything to do with peanuts, whole or in a peanut butter or anything. And linked to that is the interesting fact that peanuts are not nuts. They are, in fact, botanically speaking, a legume.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Loving your work there. Okay, Dawn.
My name is Dawn Carr. I'm the Director of Vegan Corporate Projects for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And what that means is I do outreach primarily to chain restaurants to encourage them to increase or improve their vegan provision. So our objective is to have the world be a kinder place for animals. Businesses' objective is to sell more food, so we find where those two objectives intersect and we work together to get more vegan food on the table. And my favorite sustainability fact would be that going vegan is the single biggest thing that we can do to reduce our impact on climate change. So it's more than switching to an electric car, more than cutting out air travel. Simply by eating plants instead of meat and dairy, we can change the world. And that's why the UN and leading scientists are calling for a shift to vegan eating.
Love it. And I love the way you said simply moving to this. So we'll discuss all of that in a minute. Okay, Matt.
Great. I'm Matt Luce, and I'm senior director at a think tank and advisory firm called Sustainability. And we work with companies across the agri-food value chain to help them improve environmental and social performance and see great potential, as you've already said, for food companies to improve sustainability outcomes.
Gives you a sustainable food or fact.
My favourite sustainable food has to be pulses, and so another leguminous vegetable, but I'd say lentils specifically, because they're great for protein, but also have a much lower carbon footprint than animal-based proteins.
Fantastic. Okay. My favourite sustainable food is palm weevils. They're big, fat and juicy. They infest palm hearts, and I had them in Cameroon.
There you go.
Yeah, really quite startling stuff.
Sound tasty.
Yeah, they were, but mainly squidgy. Right, first of all, let's lay down the groundwork for this. What does sustainability mean? Ursula, what does it mean to the BDA?
Well, if you get a dictionary, it means something that can be maintained. And that can refer to lots of different things. So it can refer to an economics of a project or the sustainability of a company. But what we're meaning specifically is the sustainability of the environment. Now, the environment is a million things. It's everything around us is the environment. So when you discuss it, you normally choose a few specific markers. And the main one that we're all very familiar with is greenhouse gas emissions and carbon change. But there's also other markers such as biodiversity, freshwater use. And these are the sort of measures to look at the viability of the environment in future years. Sustainability specifically relates to the environment.
And Dawn, would Peter throw in anything extra to that?
Well, yeah, I would. Obviously, sustainability is very much an environmental issue, but we're also, I feel that sustainability is also about what is acceptable and what can continue. So if you look at, again, the dictionary definition is what's defendable. The sustainability has to do with that. And what we're seeing is that, as well as awareness of the environmental damage caused by the meat and dairy industries and the health impact of diets that are heavy in these foods, there's also a huge cost that's paid by the animals themselves. And I think particularly young people are leading the change in this area. We're learning more about what the animals go through. And of course, now there are so many alternatives that are readily available to animal-based food. So it's becoming harder and harder to justify continuing to eat animals when the evidence is out there.
So there's a moral aspect to sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Matt, anything to add to the...
Yeah, I might move us on to what a sustainable food is and to try and put that in context. So a sustainable food we think of as better for the environment and actually improves environmental outcomes like biodiversity and climate change, but is also better for health, so encourages us to move away from some of the chronic diet-related diseases that we see that stem from our food system today. And then also create stronger communities, and that would mean that they for example, don't include human rights abuse in the supply chain for production. So both the environment, but also health, and then also the community and social aspects associated with food.
And the one thing we haven't mentioned here is money. Now, a lot of the people listening to this podcast will be food producers, it seems to me that there is also sustainability in profit as well. So without making money from us, the food producers won't be able to continue their work. Is there a sense of economic sustainability within this?
Well, as you say, the bottom line in the obvious statement is that if a company isn't making money, they won't make the product. So companies can only make things that are profitable to them. But I suppose we're at a stage where this huge new pressure is coming upon governments and citizens and companies, which is the limits to the environment. And to some degree, it's going to be a matter of looking at taxing or subsidising so that you're giving some support to environmentally better moves. It's not just completely down to consumers making changes in choice, but obviously consumer change in behaviour and awareness and then consequently purchasing will be a factor as well.
And this is going to become a big part of the middle of the discussion. Before we get onto that, I want to talk about the sort of the concept of sustainability for the consumer. I mean, in a sense, has sustainability become a byword for boring and worthy? And do people care enough? Because we talk about it a lot, I talk about it a lot, I see people glaze over when I start talking about it. Do you find that? I mean, Dawn, when you talk to... If you're talking to the chains, then it's a question of economic necessity, I would imagine. So I'd hope that they're on board.
Yes, well, yeah, absolutely. But it's the question of whether or not sustainable has to equal boring, it's certainly not. I mean, one case study that you can look at is the Beyond Burger, which has been fantastically successful. It's a brilliant product, but it also, if you compare it to a beef burger, it has more protein, it has more iron, it has less saturated fat than a beef burger, but it also uses 99% less water, 93% less land. So it's better for the environment, it's better for us, and it's undoubtedly better for the animals. And it's also just a delicious product. So there's a huge demand for those sorts of foods, because it helps people who maybe are interested in eating more plant-based food eat something that they might be more familiar with. So everybody knows what to do with a burger. And the Beyond Burger makes it possible to still have the flavor profile and the kind of meal that you're accustomed to, but without the environmental destruction that comes along with beef production.
Yeah. There's also been this sense of fattiness. Now, in terms of, there's lots of people who claim to be flexitarian. Now, I don't know if this is more a sense of media cliche than reality. I mean, if you're an omnivore, you're a flexitarian anyway, aren't you? I mean, if you eat meat and everything else, then you just are. Is this just a fad, or have you seen a fundamental change in the way that people eat meat?
So I'll try and tie this back to your earlier question about profit. If you take a look at the strategic priorities laid out by Tesco's and M&S and the big food retailers at the moment, indeed, actually, the big consumer products companies, there's huge innovation and huge attention around vegetarian and lower, let's call it lower impact offers. So that's the big growth area for retailers, or one of the big growth areas for retailers is this area of non-meat vegetarian diets. And they're doing that not because it's fatty, but because they see great shifts in the way that people are eating and great potential to grow markets in that space. So that's I think a really exciting area that Tesco put that as one of their top strategic priorities, growing that market for them. So
is that just a sort of metropolitan liberal elite concept, or is it something that affects everyone across the country across all demographics?
That's a great question. So there are massive differences to the way that we eat across socioeconomic groups, and I think it's very well trodden ground that things like obesity are much more prevalent in areas where there's food poverty, for example. So what is, I think as we get into this, we'll start getting into what is affordable, what's available, what do people understand in terms of their sort of food education and knowledge about what makes a good, healthy, sustainable diet. I think my sense is, you may well know the data on vegetarian diets better than I, but my sense is vegetarian diets are growing across the UK at the moment.
Well, yeah, so in the UK in the past 5 years, there's been a 469% increase in interest in vegan living. So, and I think that vegan rather than vegetarian is the way to go, because all of the reasons that anyone might give for switching to a vegetarian diet apply equally, if not more, to a vegan diet. So whether you're doing it for the environment or for your health or for the animals, a vegan diet is the way to go. And so that's what we're working on in our outreach to businesses, to encourage them to offer more vegan foods. And one example that I think illustrates how strong this can be is the Greg's Vegan Sausage Roll. So that they had a phenomenal product launch earlier this year. And in part, it was because, you know, Piers Morgan blew some hot air into their PR balloon by mocking them. But also, it was the right product at the right time. And when they thought about releasing a vegetarian sausage roll, we put together a friendly petition and we encouraged them to make it vegan, because first of all, that would be more inclusive. Nobody would choose a vegetarian sausage roll because it had a little bit of egg or milk in it, but there are certainly people who wouldn't choose it for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a sort of great paradox of cost here. Now, the cheapest things in my local supermarket are vegetables. You know, you can go into the vegetable section and make a very cheap meal, but people don't. You know, when we talk about people on low incomes and bad diets, it's often ready meals, and these are not the cheapest things in the shop. What are the barriers?
Well, the barrier, there've been lots of studies looking at how and why people purchase things, and the sheer shelf price of a food is not the only factor. A huge factor is convenience and taste. And if your income is low, a lot of foods are actually surprisingly cheap, you know, the ones that are less healthy. And saying to someone, well, actually, oats and lentils are cheaper than fish fingers and some other product, is fine and good in theory, but in practice, if you have to spend a lot of time cooking and washing up pans and the kids don't like it, in practice, most people choose foods that are quick, tasty, kids are happy, and they're familiar.
Come on then, what are you going to do about it?
Well, increased cookery skills is an important issue.
Starting young.
And starting whenever you can start. It's strange because I'm not sure the older generation, however you define them, had more cookery lessons in school. you know, to some degree, they learnt cookery skills at home. And I don't know why that shouldn't be, in theory, happening now, as it ever did. Mm. But there just seems to be a lot less willingness to spend half an hour chopping onions. Maybe because we're also distracted with other screens and other pleasurable things to do. So in practice, we seem
you,
to...
It might be for you.
We seem maybe, to be saying...
Maybe they've got two jobs they've got to run.
We seem to be saying it's got to be microwavable and ready to eat in a minute.
Yeah.
So yes, increasing cookery skills, increasing support for eating together, and of course opening people up to trying different foods to say you can have other foods that are just as delicious, it's just a matter of being exposed to them.
So Dawn, how would you convince people to eat vegan? Now, I would say that you need these things to be sexy. That people need to want, yeah, they've got to want it. And maybe that's a lot to do with marketing. You know, should we subsidise the marketing of carrots more in order to make sexy
ads?
Yes,
we should.
Yeah, I think that would be brilliant.
But I'm being serious. That's not a joke at all. I'm saying, you know, that what people have been doing hasn't really worked. I think businesses like Beyond Burger and Greg's have been fantastic at making shifts. But they've made those shifts and made them sexy. Beyond Burger's pretty cool, isn't it? Damn cool. The Impossible Burger, yeah, their marketers are being cool. If we can do more of that for people, because those are also expensive things to buy. You know,
they are
very
in the case of the
burgers.
Beyond Burger, but they're working on bringing the cost down. But it's like with the Greg's Vegan Sausage Roll, it's the same price as the meaty version.
But cooking fresh vegetarian food should be pretty cheap. How do we make that cooler? How do we make it more aspirational?
You can just look at, if I watch an ad break or watch, you know, ITV at 5 p.m. on a Saturday, and if you look at the food ads that stack up, you'll have the fast food ads. You might have a Tesco's or Asda, but the airtime and the profile given to healthy vegetarian options or healthy vegan options, or just cooking fresh vegetables and fruit, is microscopic compared to the amount of airtime that's given and money that's ploughed into advertising. Foods that are high in sugar, salt and fat. So there is some work that's happening with people trying to activate more vegetable marketing, for example. So that's definitely one of the solutions. But our whole food environment, not just what we see on TV, but walking down the high street, the whole food environment is high in foods that are high in sugar, salt and fat, rather than healthy, nutritious, wholesome foods.
Yeah, but how do we shift that? How do we change that balance?
It's a whole host of policy interventions, corporate interventions. From Transport for London have banned adverts that are high in those areas, bad food adverts on school routes, for example. So you can start trying to carve out safe spaces for children from
advertising.
Does that
work, do you think? I mean, it's worth trying, even if it doesn't work, because it's got to be something. But
seeing
but
you shaking your head over there, it's part of it.
Ursula, what's your view on this?
You know, I think there's been a lot of hope put on advertising control. And we're all exposed to adverts all the time. I'm not sure that if the products are available in the shops and the home, that not having the ads is going to hugely change people's enjoyment of fizzy drinks and a bag of chips. But the issue is, one thing that would be interesting is looking at other food cultures where high intakes of fruit and veg are typical and normal, and you can go to lots of other countries where kids just eat salads with every meal, and look at all the sort of ways that young children are picking up on this is the normal way to eat these foods. And there's been some great work done in South America looking at populations that are the poorest and finding groups or individuals that have very healthy diet, and that's called positive deviance. meaning that they are from the same social group, they're not middle class, they're not affluent. But looking at a few people who do eat very well, but live in poor estates and don't have big budgets, and try to really unpick, you know, what are the factors that are leading them to make these choices.
And what because, are they? Can you tell us?
Well, they can sometimes be just particular family traditions. Some of it links to women being in employment or not being in employment, and of course that's a whole other separate area anyway. It's just exposure in childhood to certain foods, you know, which then carries through to adulthood.
Mm. And keeping that chain alive, yes, through the generations.
There's some evidence that the sugar tax, which is obviously quite controversial in the UK at the moment, yes, is doing very important work in some parts of the world. So
yes,
that's another lever that's shown to have some potential in terms of...
That's resulted in a huge amount of reformulation by industry, and almost by default the consumer has not been the most active receiver of that. It's really that the companies have hugely shifted the spread of drinks available to the lower sugar options. And so the lower sugar options have become normalised, as opposed to sort of specific strong communication to the consumer on that issue.
So that's an example of regulation achieving its aim, whether or not it's worked as being good or bad.
It doesn't matter how it's worked, it's worked.
So this brings us then nicely to the concept of how do we get food companies to change? Is it taxation? Is it regulation? Any suggestions, guys? What's going to change things to make the food landscape more sustainable on a big scale?
Well, you can tax, or you can do the opposite of tax, which is looking at subsidies. And we are already going into that terrain at a huge speed with the dreaded B word, Brexit, which will result in a massive kind of review and debate and discussion and recalculation of subsidies and support for farmers. And of course, you know, that is the opportunity to also look at environmentalism and sustainability while you are looking at viability of different types of farming.
Is that
likely? So it's almost like a layering. It is, because up till now, you know, UK has obviously been threaded within, you know, a group of 27 other countries in terms of making agricultural decisions. And now the UK, you know, can make decisions in a more independent way.
So we're talking basically about the common agricultural policy,
yes,
and our leaving it.
Yes, but it is an opportunity.
The possibilities for that. Yeah.
But it's an opportunity for the first time to really look afresh and say, well, actually, let's consider the environment when making decisions on how to support.
Yeah.
Farming.
So let's give ourselves the privilege of being in that position right now. What would we do? What Dawn? What would you do when we reformulate the common agricultural policy for the UK? It's an opportunity. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I would like to see a shift away from meat and dairy and onto plant-based foods, and I think that.
But how? In terms of taxes, regulations.
Well, it's also
drawing
about
back subsidies.
It's about offering having the offer out there. When businesses meet the growing demand for plant-based foods, and that's a demand that's growing because of raising awareness, you know, with the internet now, there's so much information readily available that no one can deny the environmental destruction caused by the meat and dairy industries. Everybody knows about the health impacts of this, and what happens to the animals is becoming more and more widespread. But as that happens, there's a demand, and we've really seen a huge change in just, I'd say, the past 5 years or so in businesses starting to meet that demand. And huge, traditionally meat or dairy-heavy companies are diversifying into plant-based foods, like Tyson and Perdue and Danone, and all of these huge companies are seeing that vegan foods are the future, and if they want their business to stay around, they're going to have to go in that direction.
But okay, so this is a position of policy. What do we do? Do we tax? Do we regulate? Do we subsidise?
I would.
And how do you?
We would
spread that.
A meat tax would certainly be. We would support that. I think that would be a huge step in the right direction.
Has Peter thought that through? Is that a sort of a concept that you've talked about a lot?
We have talked about it a bit. We haven't done as much of it here in the UK as we have in the US.
And how's that gone down in the US?
Well, taxes always go down great when we talk about that. I mean, people love the idea of higher taxes.
Okay, enough.
Yeah. So it's hugely popular.
The farmers must hate you, though. Well, certainly the livestock farmers.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that clarification. Because it's not. You know, we all need to eat. We all need farmers. But it's the issue of who are you farming? Mm. But you know, this it's an issue of supply and demand. As the demand for meat products and dairy goes down, fewer animals will be bred to be slaughtered. People will shift to eating more plant-based foods. So it's not as though we're going to flip a switch and this will happen overnight, as fascinating as it would be to see that happen. It's going to be a slow, gradual progression. But I think we've really seen it kind of turbocharged in the past 5 years or so. Mm. I've been vegan for 35 years, and the changes that I've seen in just the past 3 to 5 years are greater than all of the years prior. So it's a very encouraging sign.
Yeah. Matt, just to draw this back again to the concepts of taxes, regulations, subsidies, whatever is at your disposal, what do you think is the best way ahead?
I think it's a whole rainbow constellation of stuff that we need to do and change. One of the things that's interesting is that our food production accounts for a huge amount of land area and provides a huge amount of environmental goods and services also. So how we manage our lands relates to climate change, it relates to biodiversity, it relates to the quality of our water. Producing food in a way that improves environmental outcomes and I suppose rewarding practices that improve environmental outcomes is something that we need to do.
That's more subsidies.
Could be subsidies. Yeah, it could be really innovative ways to connect landscape services, so create markets for landscape and environmental services, like keeping water clean. Could the water industry have a relationship with farmers that promotes clean water outcome, good water outcomes in river catchments, for example. So there's a whole host of things that have been experimented with that have great potential.
The approach to consumers is different from various different angles. I'm interested in the work, Dawn, that you've been doing with the chains, because they've got to flog their stuff. And we're not talking about subsidies here for things like a vegan sausage roll. They've just got to carry on flogging it. Now, how do they make that change? If we're trying to convince consumers, and this is, what I find interesting here is Petter is relatively confrontational in its marketing in the past, in its campaigns.
Well, not but, in the work that I'm doing with chain restaurants.
That's why I'm interested. Yes, yeah. That's why I'm interested, because is it a push mechanism or is it a shove mechanism? You know, or is it a draw to me mechanism of getting the consumer to see a sustainable diet as mainstream? How do you do it? Because as I say, you've had some spectacular campaigns in the past which have been very confrontational, but this seems to be a different approach when you're talking about chains.
Sure. Yeah. The work that we do on our corporate team is much more pragmatic than the work that our campaign team does. But we're very much building on the success of the campaign's work that we've done over the years. So for decades, PETA has been pointing out the egregious cruelty to animals in all of these industries. The more awareness that there is, the more people are looking for alternatives. But what we found was that there were people who wanted to make vegan choices, wanted to have more plant-based food, but they went to the supermarkets. They didn't know what to get. There wasn't enough choice for them, or they were going to a barbecue with friends and they didn't know what to bring. That changed a lot in the past 10 years or so, where the supermarkets really came up to offering more foods. But restaurants were lagging behind. And so our corporate work was very much answering the question of, what do I eat when I'm out with my friends in restaurants? Because that was a main concern that people had. So we looked for opportunities to work with businesses as their ally to help them meet the growing demand by putting food on the menu that would be appealing not just to vegetarians and vegans, but also meat eaters and people who just love food generally. And it seems to be going very well. You know, the businesses who have added interesting, delicious vegan options are benefiting from that.
And in terms of getting people to eat better generally? I mean, are we talking about changing educational policy, or is it because, you know, this has got to start with kids, as you were saying, it's, you know, it's about generations, you know, passing down the knowledge and the care about food. From my point of view, I see that kids need to care, they just need to know and bother a bit more about food, and then their diets seem to change.
The issue is that most kids are given a limited choice, and it has to be quick and it has to be cheap, so it will be pizza or fried chicken.
But how do we shift that?
How we shift it is partly perhaps through vanity, to explain that better health and better looks will come about if you have a healthier diet.
Sexier,
all of those things. All of those things, which especially teenagers will be very open to.
We should just lie to them. Yeah, meat gives you spots. But suddenly, if we
you don't have to lie to them if you're talking about dairy giving you spots.
Oh,
so we've got that.
Very good.
But if you change diets by reducing or eliminating animal proteins, then of course it is important to make sure that what you're having in its place is healthy. Because you can have a diet that's only chips, which is a vegan diet, but it's not healthy.
Right. Yeah.
So you need to have a diet that covers, you know, your nutrient requirements. And there are, of course, lots of expensive upmarket vegan products out there. But if you're thinking about the average person, that, you know, it has to be available and cheap and tasty. To some degree, it's possibly looking at fortification, things like breakfast cereals, and especially for a vegan diet, dietitians would be very anxious to communicate that they should take a B12 supplement or a B12 fortified food. Mm. But yes, there is far more choice, and the choice that's available for lower meat products is cheaper and more delicious.
Yeah,
so the market is responding. The market is responding.
Yeah. Okay. I think we should offer one last thing. If each of you can tell me what the simple, what's the low-hanging fruit to create sustainable diet easily for the masses? What's the simple thing that everyone can do? Is it a food that they can eat? Is it more jackfruit?
Every food company, you mean? Or?
No, food company could be food company, or it could be telling people at home as well. Food company would be best because they're the people who are probably going to be listening here.
Yeah.
What's the one thing you would suggest to them to help in their responsibility as well to make sustainability a mainstream concept? Sustainable diets a mainstream concept, Matt.
Yeah, it starts with better products for me. So it's inspiring, exciting, tasty, healthy, good for the environment products. And the information that consumers need around that, or we all need around that, to understand why it's better, why it's good for us, and how it, and make informed choices about the food that we buy and eat.
And how do you tell them that it's better? I mean, what's the magic thing that, I mean, is it, how do you make it sexy?
Yeah, I think anything from labels and standards helps. So things like fair trade or organic are great labels that are an indicator that this has got some good credentials behind it. To the M&S's of this world do great campaigns in stores about, you know, why their products are healthy, indulgent, and good for the environment, or good for us. So I think it's a combination of on-pack stuff, in-store stuff, and then marketing outside of store and other media channels, and all of that is completely worthless, though, if the product isn't tasty, healthy, and wonderful to start with.
Magic.
Yeah, exactly. Magic. Yeah.
Dawn, what's the low-hanging fruit for you from your point of view?
Well, you know, I think there are so many things in the world that we would like to change that we're powerless to change, and that can be a very frustrating position to be in. But there's one simple thing that we can all do to make the world a kinder place and to improve the outcome for the planet and for the environment, and that's to switch to a vegan diet. And it, with all of the amazing innovation that we're seeing in this area, it's never been easier. And, you know, the power is in our hands. We can make that switch, and it is becoming more mainstream, more readily available. You go to any Wetherspoons in the UK and you've got a vegan menu right there. So, you know, that I think that's very encouraging that it's becoming easier to make choices that can have a positive impact.
And how do we push people towards that, though? How do we make that the preferred option?
Well, I think it's just raising awareness of the downsides of not doing that. Well, the catastrophic results of our not changing course as a culture, as a society. You know, we need the planet, and if we don't make some serious changes to the way that we eat, you know, there really won't always be more fish in the sea.
That's a sort of negative way to get to a positive outcome. Do you think that's a viable way to go about it?
I think you need to do
a threat.
Yeah, I think
approach.
You need to point to both things, because these are the results of us not taking action, but then you also have the positive side, which is look at all of these amazing vibrant foods.
Which we don't see the positive side. It's more the fear and the scare rather than the, well, hang on, look at what we could do.
Yeah, but there is some really exciting stuff happening in that area that there's, I don't know if you're familiar with Bosch, but they're a social media duo that do point of view cooking videos. And it's really clever what they've done, because they shoot from above while they're putting together the recipe. So you can imagine that those are your hands making that amazing vegan dish. And it's all exciting food, it's beautifully produced, and it gets people interested in cooking for themselves. So there it's not just pointing out the negatives, it's also showing that look at all these amazing things that we can do.
I'd like to see more of that, I think. I think that might be a fundamental shift. Ursula, what's the low-hanging fruit? What's the easy thing to do?
Well, I think for dietitians, a very small minority of the population are vegan, but the issue is actually the 96% or so that are still meat eaters, that they continue to eat meat but reduce. So the reduction in total meat is going to be much, much more from meat eaters eating less than from a few people becoming vegan.
Like Meat Free Monday and
that kind of thing. I'm a bit anxious about the answer being touted as exotic products flown from tens of thousands of miles away, such as jackfruit, and depleting sort of, you know, other cultures of what is their traditional food. I really think that we need to try and remain within kind of historical UK food supply in terms of...
I was just going around some jackfruit. I'm enjoying that jackfruit burger.
So, you know, cookery skills, as we've said, adding spices, adding herbs, looking at cuisines from other countries, for example, Indian cuisine that traditionally has been based on pulses and beans, and finding ways in which they make these foods accessible and delicious to everyone. And, you know, exposure and enthusiasm.
Okay, I think we should draw to a close there, exactly there. I think that's been fantastic, and it's given a really good overview of sustainability and the possibilities as well. So, Ursula Ahrens, Dawn Carr, Matt Luce, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.